We'll get going. Today, I think we're being double teamed. We've got Assistant Commissioner Meyer, and I thought I saw Assistant Commissioner Cramp here too.
Mr. Chair, actually, Marty Vadas will be joining us momentarily or when we get to that section of the presentation and talk a little bit about the status of mining operations currently.
Well, that'll be good, Commissioner. I understand that recently he's announced his retirement, so I think the timing will be good. It's a shame to lose a resource like him as a dedicated state employee, so there could be some members may have questions for him. Well, welcome back,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, why don't you go ahead.
For the record, my name is Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Where we left off Tuesday, I guess it was talking about state forest land management. Hopefully you still have those presentations with you. Otherwise, I do have copies up on the table here today. And we were talking about some of the supporting programs within the Forestry Division. We manage 4.9 million acres of state lands. Of that, about 2.4 are school trust lands. And of those school trust lands, only about 1.4 are productive commercial forest timberland. The other trust lands are probably remaining swamp lands and things like that that we manage for those characteristics. The state did have over 18 million acres of trust land, but most of them have been sold that were productive and that were of value for agriculture and other things like that. But you do see in lands bills from time to time the department selling or exchanging school trust lands that to either generate revenue or to make the patchwork system of land that we have more productive. So the supporting programs on our management side of forestry include timber management, silvicultural, and roads. We have an extensive network of forest roads throughout the state in the northern part of the state that not only provide access for the loggers, but provide critical access for the recreationalists that are out there, the deer hunters, the grouse hunters, bird watchers, campers. You can camp in state forest lands. There are a few restrictions, days, number of days, and things like that. For the most part, you can be in those woods and enjoy them at your leisure. Forest certification, we talked about that, the ecological classification system, and forest land management and planning. Cooperative forest management, we touched on with our family forest program, urban and community forestry, and forest legacy. This helps those private landowners who own a substantial chunk of the forested part of the state understand how they should manage their lands and the options and benefits of active forest management. Core programs in this area include our forest health, forest nursery programs, utilization and marketing, biomass utilization and development. Those two programs help develop new markets and help make sure the markets are sustained, the pulp, the logwood, other opportunities for development. Our state forests not only provide economic opportunity in the forested lands, there's a large amount of economic development that occurs out of the secondary timber market, cabinet making, paper industry. A lot of those are in outside of the forested areas as well. There's a lot of jobs related to timber manufacturing, wood manufacturing here in the metropolitan area. Information and education, information systems, land asset management, making sure that we're managing our state forests and the boundary disputes, exchanges, sales out of our forested unit. There's pieces that go on there. And also our Forest Resource Council, timber harvesting and forest management guideline monitoring. Mr. Chair, I do believe you've heard from the Forest Resource Council, or will be shortly, hopefully. They do provide a good sounding board for the development and resolution of our forest issues that come out, and also make sure that we're managing our forests in the most productive ways. Related to that is the Sustainable Forest Resource Act implementation. This is incorporating multiple perspectives on managing, using, and protecting our forests to achieve the state's economic, environmental, and social goals. At the beginning, we talked about the three circles of the DNR: recreation, economics, and sustainable development opportunities. Forestry really exemplifies those three circles altogether. We need to make sure that we're harvesting enough wood to make sure that our industry can stay productive and active, but we also need to do that in a way that's sustainable and provides for the long-term protection of those forests. And also, they're a huge operation for recreational opportunity that's out there, especially in the fall when the leaves are changing and there's bird seasons going on and other things like that. Some of the programs here are our sightline guideline developments and improvements, landscape planning, policy development and operations and research. A few of the priority outcomes and measures. One is just talking about making sure that we're meeting our forestry objectives and offering at least 800,000 cords. This should say of new timber or wood for sale each year. We also end up offering a substantial amount of timber reoffered for sale, 200,000-300,000 cords sometimes. But so our actual goals that we have on the books is to get about 1 million cords of wood on the market each year. Of that, hopefully at least 8,000 is new timber. So we actively manage our timber sales to make sure that we are putting up enough wood for sale to continue our market driven approach. And you can see the targets and what has been offered there. 09, a little bit over 900,000. 08, a little bit over 800,000 of new timber. It is a delicate balance that we face, especially again this year. We'll put timber up for sale, and with all of the snow, the swamps and things aren't frozen enough. We're having we've extended all of our timber sales due to adverse conditions for another year, because the loggers can't get into the wet areas with their equipment, and hopefully it'll be able to get in there this spring, or it'll get really cold. Well, maybe you don't want it to be really cold, but there's a lot of people who depend on really cold weather to make a living, so this is just one group of them. Forest inventory, making sure that we know what's on our lands, and as far as timber harvest and timber production, tracking forest changes and providing information needed for making sound management decisions. This is similar to our game and fish creel census and population estimates that we do, but we're looking at trees rather than animals. Moving on to the Division of Lands and Minerals, this division is responsible for managing our real estate portfolio and also managing our state-owned mineral assets. Some of the chapters of statutory authorities that are underlying this division include 84, acquisitions, easements, state lands, in Chapter 92, mineral lands, in 93, 94 with lands and state forests, and 282, tax forfeited land sales. The state does hold in trust the tax forfeited land for the county. They manage them, but we kind of hold the deed, and you'll see tax forfeited land sale issues within lands bills. The budget for lands and minerals, and this is going to be a little bit different in the coming weeks as we talk about budgets. It's my understanding PILT will not be discussed in this committee, but in the tax committee. So this 65% of the lands and minerals budget will be discussed in the tax committee with local government aid issues, is my understanding. So focusing on the remaining pieces of the budget here in lands and minerals, it's 11.2% or $7.5 million from the general fund, $10.9 million from the natural resources fund, $2.8 million from the game and fish fund, $1.9 million from special revenue, and we have a small amount of environmental trust fund dollars working on an easement stewardship and monitoring project that we have. From the general fund, it supports our activities. I'll get into a little bit more, but we have been looking at lands and minerals as one of the divisions that where the general fund has been supporting commercial activities, that those activities have to pay for those services. Now, this is a theme that you'll see throughout our budget, or you have seen in the past. But really, where there are commercial activities that are being done, easements, things like that for utilities, crossings, we've gone to a fee-for-service that on those types of activities, because we can no longer, or the general fund can no longer support paying for those types of activities. Managing the real estate transactions on 5.5 million acres of state-owned lands is a big part of what we do on the real estate side of things. For all of the department, ecological and water resources, fish and wildlife, forestry, parks, and trails, the transactions are managed here. We also coordinate the payment of lieu of taxes program, where we collect the data from the county assessors and the acreages of the different types of lands that are out there by county, and then we send that over to the Department of Revenue, and they send the payments out. Our land asset management program is located here, and this is something that we're going to spend a lot of time on, hopefully actually get you guys to see or come over to the department and see our new system once it's up and running. But we've been building a new land management record system over the past 4 years. It'll be coming live here in the next pieces of it will start in the summer. It'll be completely implemented a little bit less than a year from now. But really, we're digitizing all of our land records that we have, all of the deeds, all of the documents, the maps and things like that. And those will be accessible not only to you but to the general public through our website. It's getting us into the state-of-the-art of land management or land record management, and it will make everything operate more efficiently, our transactions. It increases the amount of transparency and accountability, knowing where boundary lines are, knowing where the land came from, knowing what the easements and what the conditions are on those lands that we can all then understand, and it'll help us enforce and monitor those conditions as well. We're also looking at land, exchanging lands that we should be exchanging, selling lands that we should be selling, and really acquiring the conservation lands that should be protected. It's a term you hear sometimes, but precision conservation, they talk about in the Lasard Sams Council. It's buying the best and trying to protect the rest if we have to, or exchange and consolidate our holdings. It's the work we've done in Roseau County is just the tip of the iceberg, and where we want to go with this stuff is looking at on a parcel-by-parcel basis what should be sold, what can we exchange with the county, and where do we want to protect lands, in holdings within our units, WMAs, AMAs, SNAs, parks, or lands that are contiguous to those boundaries are some of our highest priorities. It's people often think, and we've talked about a little bit, that the DNR wants to buy all of the land. Well, it's not true. We're working with our stakeholders and you all to meet the needs of the citizens that they want to have done, protect land, make sure they have access to hunt, fish, camp, bird watch, berry pick, whatever. But also we need to recognize our constituencies at the local county government level. They have needs as well for land. They need to generate revenue off of those lands, and we're working hard to make sure that we can work together to do what we all need to do. It's going to be a process we're formalizing, at least in some of the larger counties where we own land in the immediate future. The trust fund lands, Mr. Chair and members, I think this is an issue that we have been paying a lot of attention to. There's a permanent school trust fund advisory committee that I know Representative McNamara sits on that talks about how we manage land, how do we generate the revenue off of these trust lands, and how do we do that in an environmentally sound method as the law requires us to, and the commissioner of the DNR is the fiduciary trust holder for the benefit of the children of those lands, and we do the best we can. The timber industry has been challenging on the timber side of it, but you'll hear about the mining side of things and how things have been working on that. I spoke of our lands record system and our conservation easement stewardship program, which will be rolling out a more formalized process once that LCCMR project is completed.
Mr. Meyer, I'm going to interrupt you briefly. I believe that Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Meyer, on the real estate management, and for example, if the public gives money to a nonprofit to purchase land and then the land then gets donated back to the state, what's the process on that? Is there county board approval for that nonprofit when they look to purchase the land?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the process that we use on that, there's in statute language that requires the DNR to receive county board approval for wetlands, for wildlife. It was the precursor of the WMA program, and that statute's in 97A. When we acquire land, we actively work with the county boards to seek their approval. If they do not approve, they have 90 days to do so. Sometimes the counties elect not to take any action. Then we go ahead with our process, with our acquisition. If they deny that approval, there's a process that we can use to petition to the Land Exchange Board to do that. We rarely go against their wishes, only in extreme cases. The other side of it, on the third-party donations, we have an operational order that requires the third party to notify, and the DNR to notify the county board before that donation is accepted. But there's nothing in statute or in our policy that requires approval for those transactions at this time.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Meyer, when those third-party acquisitions occur and it goes to through lands and minerals and the appraisal process, do the third-party acquisitions have to have the same rigor in evaluation and appraisal as, say, a state acquisition? And also, as that process goes, if that goes through, who's paying for that appraisal and the steps as it goes through the process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the vigor and the requirements that are held by the third parties are basically our third party, what's in the land sale, the landowner bill of rights. A third party cannot go out and pay more than the appraised value of a piece of land. Some people think third parties are going up and bidding up at auction. But they need to follow the same processes that we do. As far as the actual costs associated with acquiring those lands, it varies by the appropriation source. I think in most cases those costs are covered by the appropriation dollars of the fund that they're getting. But we can get you more information on that specifically. Certainly when we're appropriated dollars through a bonding bill, those costs are covered that way. So,
One more follow-up,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Commissioner Meyer, so if with an acquisition it needs to go through the Lands and Minerals Division, whether it's third party or within the agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, our Lands and Minerals Division works at some stage of that third party acquisition. If it's a third party that's appropriated dollars to buy land out of a dedicated fund, they can go out and acquire that land without our services. But once it comes to the state side, then there's work that we do to accept that, the deed work and all those things. But we aren't doing the real estate transactions in most cases for some of these appropriations that you'll find in the Outdoor Heritage Fund that go to an organization. I don't believe we're doing that level of work right now.
Okay. Make it quick, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That raised another question. But is it in the last two Outdoor Heritage appropriations, there was a requirement that the DNR commissioner sign off on every acquisition. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes, I think I'm not quite understanding this particular process.
Representative, please address the chair.
So sorry. Mr. Chair, if there's state money that goes to a nonprofit and it is not for a designated piece of land, it is for a nonprofit, but it's state dollars, does that nonprofit have to get permission from the state to accept that land before that nonprofit purchases it or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, in previous languages in the LCCMR, Environmental Trust Fund Bill, and the Outdoor Heritage Fund Bill over the past two cycles, there's language that requires commissioner approval for those activities.
Follow-up, Representative?
If I remember correctly, in the LCCMR, that was put in statute, not it wasn't in rider language. So are you saying it's different than for lands that come through the Heritage Committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, not to date. I do not believe that language is in the Outdoor Heritage Fund bill for commissioner approval currently. I believe that has been taken out. But to go back to the appraisal side, we review all the appraisals like we would do a state appraisal. So, but just to get that on the record.
It's not the appraisal issue that I am interested in. It is the state taking on the long-term management of a piece of land without ahead of time saying, yes, that's a good idea for the citizens of Minnesota to take it on. So I think that's a legal question that we should spend some time in committee chatting about. Do you understand?
Thank you, Representative. I agree with you that these transactions need to be, the process of these transactions need to be reevaluated. I have a question for Mr. Meyer myself. If a private party buys a piece of land and then donates it to a nonprofit, and then the nonprofit then turns it over to the DNR. Do we have the same restrictions in that process on how much is paid for that land originally?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Marty Vadas weigh in on this one. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm Marty Vadas, the Director of Lands and Minerals Division, and could you go through that one more
diagram at all?
If a private party buys a piece of land and then turns and sells it to, sells that piece of property to a nonprofit, and the nonprofit then donates it to the DNR, do we have the same restrictions on, for instance, how much can be paid for that piece of land?
Mr. Chair, in your question, does that mean then that the state eventually did pay for that land? Is that or
No, donated by the NGO to the state.
On a donation, Mr. Chair, we would not do an appraisal. We would determine whether or not it was in the state's interest to own that land. There have been examples where we have turned down donations because, for example, if there's a conservation easement on a piece of land, people have in the past attempted to donate the underlying remaining fee interest to the land, and we looked at that and decided the land is already protected. And so we'd be taking on tilt responsibility and management responsibility for the remainder of the land, and so we rejected that donation. So I don't know if that answers your question, but in the case of a donation, we don't do an appraisal.
Thank you. I believe we'll come back to this issue on another day. I'm sorry. Representative Hans. Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, you mentioned the work that's going on in Roseau County, and I appreciate that. I've talked to our county commission. Do you have some suggestions for, I don't mean to beat this dead horse, but for streamlining the process? Commissioner Swanson told me that this land exchange that we're trying to do, that both parties want to do, has now taken, I believe, 2 years, and it still has not been resolved. So do you anticipate having some solutions for streamlining this process? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's an excellent question, and thank you for bringing it up. Once we decide who should have what and figure out what checkerboards we want and how to consolidate, it is a costly and time-consuming process. I think when Commissioner Landwehr was here talking with you, he's very interested in trying to expedite that process and maybe do some of these exchanges statutorily or look at other ways to streamline it. So I'm hoping that we will have some language before you on the new lands bill that comes up to help us do this in an expedited, more cost-efficient manner. Mr. Chair, just back on that note about acquisitions with third parties and other councils and dedicated funds, people are working off of our priority lists. We're working very closely with the stakeholders so they understand where we want to be, what our priorities are, and I'd say most, if not all the time, the parcels that are being acquired, at least in the past several years, have been top priority parcels for the department. So we're getting a handle on this. I think it's getting a lot better. And we need to work more jointly together to make sure that that's occurring.
Thank you. One more question, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If that is the case, why do we have such a backlog in purchasing SNA properties? Because there's a huge backlog there, bigger backlog there than any place else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, that becomes a matter of the funding that we have available that is appropriated to those programs. I understand your question. Most of the SNA dollars either come from bonding or the Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund. There's some that are recommended in this year's Outdoor Heritage Fund bill. There were some in the past, but there is a disproportionate amount of lands that have not been acquired on the SNA side of it, and we come in with trying to come in with a balanced portfolio for acquisition, and I think the decisions that are made drive us to where we end up buying those acquisitions or purchasing those lands.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the, and maybe I'm observing wrong, but it seems to me that much of the SNA is not in the northern part of the state where people say, we don't want any more acquisition. It tends to be in the southern part of the state. by the Mississippi River in the southern part of the state, or just in general in the west. And so that it isn't making sense to me, because I think many people expected with the Heritage Fund some of those lands would be acquired.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think more of those lands are starting to be acquired now than they have in the past, and stakeholders understand the need to do that more and want to do that more. One of the things that we're looking at is not getting so boxed into these units of the Outdoor Rec Act that provide us protection, but really rigid rules and regulations, but managing land for those qualities across all areas of the Outdoor Recreation Act, so that we open up opportunities. And I think we need to look at things a little bit differently into the future sometimes and look at that. But how can we protect an SNA for those attributes, but also use it for other activities as well? And it's something that we're really excited about, Commissioner Landwehr's really excited about, and I think the stakeholders want to do more of that too. We need to protect the land for the values that are there and open up opportunities rather than restrict opportunities. And to me, that's going to be the success of our program. So I appreciate your comments and look forward to making sure that we can do that more in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I Mr. Chair, thank you. Sorry
I
for...
I just would like to remind you of one thing. My farm is not for sale.
Thank you.
Mine, Mr. Chair.
Moving on to the Minerals Management Activities, and we'll have Director Vadas talk a little bit about the status of minerals management when we get to the end of these slides here. We actively manage the mineral activities on about 12 million acres of state-owned lands and encourage the development of expansion of mineral deposits in an environmentally sound manner. That picture there is a picture of our core drill library in Hibbing. And if you're ever in the area or have the opportunity to stop by and see it, it's a really fascinating place that people come from all over the world to see. People are required to deposit samples of their cores when they drill and do research, and we library it and catalog it. And it's it not only shows the history of activity, but it shows really what is in our state and below our surfaces. So supporting programs, mineral title research, lease administration for these exploratory leases, mining engineering, and then the resources program, including the drill sampling and analysis, mineral information for local governments and public investing in research. Aggregate research comes out of this area as well, which is an important commodity for all of us throughout the state, besides all of our other mining activities. The Mineland Reclamation is also housed in this division here, enforcing these regulations at taconite, peat, and non-ferrous operations, which affect over 250,000 acres of public and private land. We do some substantial work with environmental review and mine permitting, inspections, cooperative research, and other forms of cooperative research aimed at improving reclamation techniques. Mercury research is conducted here on emissions, and also how can we mine better, more efficiently, and more sustainably. Some of the priority outcomes you can see here is state non-ferrous metallic minerals, just the growth that has occurred. These are exploratory leases. Over 500 leases are currently going on right now. You can see that over 161,000 acres. And I'll let Marty talk about this next couple slides, and we can get into the discussion that I think Representative McNamara wanted to talk a little bit about the ongoing mining activities that have been going on in the state and what that means to the general fund and the school trust fund and things like that.
Mr. Chair, members, this slide just is sort of a measure of what's going on in Minnesota in relation to mineral exploration for mineral deposits. As you can see, the last few years have been very active. In 2010, for example, about 50 miles of bedrock drill core has been drilled.
Mr. Vadas, can I just have you move the microphone a little closer to your mouth?
Thank you. And in case any of you haven't seen drill core, this is a piece of bedrock drill core from the Duluth complex. It's similar to the kind of material that Polymet, for example, is proposing to mine. And the technique is to drill a hole, and there have been about 200 separate holes that have been drilled in 2010, and take a sample of the bedrock. And as Commissioner Meyer mentioned, we store that in Hibbing. And also on this slide, I have charted the price of copper. And so that squiggly line on this graph then is the price of copper. In 2002, it was something less than a dollar, and the top of the slide here is $4, and actually today copper is about $4.50 a pound. And so it really is one of the basic reasons that is driving the exploration here in the state. And this slide then shows for state mineral lands, the mineral receipts that DNR has collected from the mineral leases that are in existence. And it reflects in 2010 the general downturn in the economy, and that affected the iron ore and taconite business in a big way. That has rebounded to where we should have taken a record amount of royalty income in 2011, and our projection for next fiscal year is that number will rise to $42 million, and that's without any additional mineral development. And if I could take a second to go around the state and a little bit about what is going on. I think you've heard about PolyMet and the proposal that they have, and probably heard about expansions of taconite plants like at Keewatin Taconite, where they intend to go from 6 million tons to nearly 10 million tons. But there are a number of other activities that are going on. One that you may have heard of is called Mesabi Nugget, and I have some samples of what that product is. And this is the first one of these plants that's been built in the world, and it was built here in Minnesota. It's a process that was developed by Kobe Steel from Japan. And instead of making a taconite pellet that needs to go to a blast furnace, this plant will make a 500,000 tons of what's essentially pig iron that can go to a blast furnace, but it also can go to like an electric arc furnace. And an example of that is North Star Steel in St. Paul. They theoretically could take this product and use it from the mines here in Minnesota. The company that's developing this project is Steel Dynamics from Indiana, and they are a mini mill operator and tend to use most of the product themselves. And another new development is the iron feed for this nugget process is coming from a company called Magnetation, and that's a two-year-old company, and they are going back into natural iron ore tailings basins that have been mined 80, 90 years ago, and they have a process to extract the remaining iron from those tailing waste products from those old operations. And you may have read recently that Cargill has invested in that company, and they are expanding. They now have, I believe it's a 4.5 million ton contract with a blast furnace in Mexico. So it's very interesting use of old material. And just a side note, about 20 years ago we put about $30,000 of research money into that process, and it's been developed through the years to the point now where it's able to use that formerly uneconomic waste material and turn it into a product.
Thank you. I believe Representative McNamara has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Vadas, I'm glad you were able to come in this morning. It's pretty neat and interesting to listen to what you have to say. One thing, does the I have one question, then another one. First one, on the magnetation, that process and that company, so will they go in and where 50 years ago we just kind of dumped these piles every which way? So when they go back in, will they clean them up to today's standards and restore the land differently than we allowed them to do 50 years ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, what they're concentrating on is the natural ore tailings basin. So they're not piles, they're a tailings pond. And those were constructed with no permits at the time at all, because it didn't exist. And the intention of this company is to, after they go through and recover the iron from these basins, to restore those to wetlands so that they can receive wetlands credit and put them in probably a better condition than they are today.
An unrelated question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vadas, we're disappointed that you're leaving the employment of the state of Minnesota. At least I am. And thank you for what you've done. You're an amazing state employee. And can you just tell the committee what are the value of the leases over the next 50 years that you've negotiated? What if I just zeroed in on the school trust land? What's the potential conservative estimate of the revenue for the school trust land and the optimistic estimate for the revenue on the school trust land if we're able to find a way to protect the environment and move forward with some of the special mental leases that you've negotiated with folks over the last years?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, from the Luth Complex deposits, the copper-nickel deposits that are known in the state, there are substantial amounts of leases on school trust land and tax forfeit land and university trust land. And I was asked a couple of years ago, what might that mean to the school trust? And I had no idea. And so we went and made a calculation that should those school trust lands that are part of these deposits be developed, if they're able to get permitted, and you know, that's a high hurdle, but if they are able to be permitted over about a 25-year period, what was known at that time would result in about $1.4 billion of income to the school trust fund. And since that was done, there's been more drilling. The amount of resource has increased about 50% since then. And so I haven't updated that estimate, but I guess it would be safe to say that there's a potential large economic return to the school trust fund should those deposits be mined.
Representative Wagenius, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to Mr. Vadas for your service to Minnesotans. We really appreciate it. And I'm sorry that you're not going to be with us. As you were talking about reclaiming something waste, have you all ever explored the possibility of reclaiming things like the silver and gold that would be in our old landfills? Have looked at that as a source of mining?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there are isolated examples from around the world where that has been done. But it's not a usual or normal activity. There usually is something else going on that sort of spurs you to go in and do something in that landfill. And the reason is that it just is very uneconomic to try to attempt to do that with today's markets and technology for the remaining silver, for example, that might be in those. So there has to be some other compelling reason to go in and try to do something with that landfill. It just doesn't make any economic sense for the most part.
Paula?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In most places, the landfills would be controlled by private parties. In Minnesota, they're controlled by, we are the underlying owner, which makes one difference in economics. But there are places where maybe the landfill in Eden Prairie, where when we run into problems where it's leaking into the river, that we have other problems that we have to deal with. So it does make some sense to me for us to at least think about, instead of just covering up the problem and knowing it's leaking underneath, where there are some that are particularly leaky, that we ought to be using those bonding dollars that we're sending to the state to think a little bit differently.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I would strongly encourage you to think of this issue maybe a little differently, and that's before it gets to the landfill to recover those metals, because there is only so much of those metals in. Putting them in a landfill makes absolutely no sense to me at all. So if there is a way to capture those, return them to productive use before they make it to a landfill, like, for example, steel. That's the most highly recycled metal that we have. And so the industry does, because of the economics, does a very good job of recycling steel. Most of the feed for these mini mills, which produces more than half of the steel in this country, is recycled steel. And so going down that road for other types of metals makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. I believe Representative Hilty has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bates, one would assume that the price of copper being what it is today is due to demand. Do you know where the demand is coming from largely?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, in the metals business across the board, if you look to Asia, it's the source of the increase in demand. For example, worldwide, 10 years ago, about 900 million tons of steel were produced. Today, that's getting closer to 2 billion tons of steel. And increased demand is coming from places like China and India, but also from Russia and Brazil as well. And so it really then is driving the world price. It used to be sort of a regional market for metals, more or less. Our iron ore mines here serve the upper Midwest, essentially the East Coast as well. Now, taconite is viewed as sort of a world commodity, and it's based on a world price, and that's being driven by Asia.
A follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bates, is there anything in any of the leasing agreements that we have that would restrict in any way where the products produced in the mining operations in Minnesota would end up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, our lease is silent on where the material will actually be used. It's related to the terms and conditions for producing it here in Minnesota and how the state will be compensated for the use of that material.
Mr. Chair, the reason for asking that is that sometimes we hear endeavors like this promoted as somehow related to our own economic or national security. And I'd just like to point out that there isn't anything that says that metals mined in northern Minnesota are not going to end up in China or India. Same thing with oil produced in North Dakota. And to think that the reason for doing that has anything to do with our own state or national interest other than the revenue that's produced initially is just misguided.
Thank you for that comment. I believe Representative Beard has a question.
Well, thank you. I did, related to reclamation, but Representative Hilty always stimulates the most interesting discussions. Thank you, Representative Hilty. On the whole energy thing, the whole notion of energy independence is actually a fallacy that we should probably talk through sometime because, folks, we are indeed connected to an international market, and whatever is happening for demand on copper in China, it affects the price we get from stuff out of the northeastern part of this state. Whatever happens to the price of or the demand for coal in Indonesia affects the price we pay for the stuff we're competing with in Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota. It's an international market, and I think that the best part we could do for security is to grow up and be adults and play in that market and help assure that there actually is stable international trade. Just my opinion. Now to and we should have a great conversation on this someday. To my point, though, about Representative Wagenius's comment about reclamation and about landfills, folks, I think she's on to something here. And this is something I maybe for future legislators should continue or to consider, and maybe perhaps the DNR, but that has to deal with the landfills that are out there now and the fact that they actually are resource pits. There's stuff in those things that's going to be very valuable to our kids and our grandkids. And so we may want to be thinking about landfills. Instead of thinking of them as toxic dumps that are poisoning us, here's an opportunity to actually reclaim them by selling the mining rights. And the stuff that's in there becomes more valuable over time, which harks back to an old adage you've heard me say here. It's a Julius Simon comment that nothing cures high prices like high prices. Well, fact of the matter is, folks, high prices cure a lot of things. And whenever the price of stuff that's in a landfill, like all those computers we dumped in there before July of a couple years ago, those are pretty valuable resources. And as the price of those minerals and precious metals in there comes up, folks will find a way to do things differently to reclaim those things. We're actually already mining, in a sense, the Eden Prairie landfill. There are methane pipes in there. I don't know about the notion that the thing is leaking into the groundwater Minnesota River. Could be. Perhaps we should mine it, take out all the cool stuff that's valuable, and redo that pit. We could. But the fact of the matter is, at the moment, there are actually, I think, four Cat diesels been converted to run on methane that are actually pumping out something in the neighborhood of about 120 kilowatts a day, round the clock, mining the methane off of that that pit. One more time, I'm going to hark back to my roots in Pennsylvania and the family farm, the one on the Beard side that Uncle Jack owns, that was mined by shaft in the 1880s, strip mined in a rudimentary fashion in the early part of the last century, and left with open cuts, which we called scars, I think, on the first Earth Day. That was part of what motivated a lot of us to get involved. We're going to reclaim the scar-faced mining deal. Well, that piece of property in the 1970s and the 1980s was mined two more times as the price of coal went up, and every time they mined it, they made the farm a better place than it was when they found it. And it kind of illustrates the point that was being made about what's happening on the Iron Range, that sometimes yesterday's mess turns into today's asset and today's opportunity. So sometimes there's other ways to fix these things up than spending lots of money covering up the coal just because somebody's going to come in 10 years from now and re-mine it and take it because it's valuable tomorrow and not quite so valuable today. I guess my comment is that sometimes what these things go around, they take care of themselves, and nothing cures problems like high prices at some time.
Thank you. Mr. Vedas, have you finished? Yes. I have one more question for you. I'd like you to estimate how many times you've appeared before this committee in your career.
Mr. Chair, a few. And it's always been a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today. Mr. Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I think that was a great conversation. Moving on to another leg of our economic programs that we have in the department. I know people don't think of parks and trails as an economic stimulus area, but they really are. The people who go to these great places within the state, the parks, the trails, are spending dollars. They are buying gas, they're buying groceries, they're staying oftentimes where we have park visitors, they're staying. Only 25% of our park visitors actually stay within the state parks. Most of them will stay within a resort or a hotel or something adjoining to it. So it really does spur a lot of economic activity as well. The vision of the Parks and Trails Division is to create unforgettable park, trail, and water rec experiences that inspire people to pass along the love for the outdoors to current and future generations. But the statutory authorities here lie under several different areas, 84, 85, 86A, which is the Outdoor Rec Act that we spoke of, 97A.141. Major issue that we're facing here is just a generation growing up largely disconnected to the outdoors, and we've been spending a lot of time the past couple of years to help these kids get outside and really enjoy what we're all about. Strategic objectives: connecting people to the outdoors, accelerating the management of these areas, our natural, cultural, and recreational environments to continue to preserve the best for Minnesota, and invest in partnerships, processes, and people. We've really been doing entrepreneurial activities within the park system over the past couple of years, not only on the promotion side of it, but also on the way we attract people in within our I Can Camp program. We actually had an I Can Camp event at the State Fair that was hugely successful, making sure people know how to set up a tent, how to camp. It's a huge barrier for some people, especially single families and things like that, who are afraid to go out and try to take this on their own, and it's been a huge success. Reaching out to other cultures and also providing more technologically based activities such as geocaching, which with the kids we have today with the electronic GPSs was just something that's just taken off on its own, and some of those other successes that we've had. You can see the funding sources here, largely 45%, 46% from the Natural Resources Fund, from the funds generated from activities, park daily and yearly entrance passes, daily camping fees, firewood, shirts, things like that. The general fund makes up the other large portion of this at $41.5 million. Some trust fund money to do specific activities, federal funds, special revenue funds, Parks and Trails Fund from the dedicated accounts, the legacy dollars, So it had specific purposes that we'll talk about in the coming weeks. And there is some game and fish fund dollars within this budget as well. You can see it talking about connecting people to the outdoors. We have several supporting programs, our internal interpretive services and public affairs and outreach, trying to help people connect with nature and provide recreational and educational activities that enrich experiences, appreciation, and understanding outdoors is extremely important to us. Likewise, making sure we're taking care of what we have, accelerating the management of our natural, cultural, and recreational environments, providing for the diverse and connected system within our parks and trails, looking at how we're connecting parks and trails to each other. We're going to be kicking off on February 14th, Mr. Chair and members, our 10-year, 25-year legacy plan, parks plan, that was funded out of the park and trail dollars, out of the legacy funds. We encourage you all to join us. It's going to be Monday, February 14th at 10:45. We're going to have a celebration in the Rotunda of the Capitol. We're actually going to have some 5th and 6th grade students there participating with us. But this document will lead us into the next decade or two decades of how we're going to be doing and managing some of these dollars and where our park system is going. Providing more accessible, consistent, and accurate information for the public is extremely important. Our resource assessment and protection management, we've been able to accelerate this with these heritage or legacy fund dollars. Also, our research plan and design, operations, maintenance, and renewal is something that we always talk about, especially with bonding dollars. We have the ability to spend bond dollars extremely quickly through all parts of the state. I would bet that we could spend, or we are spending, bonding dollars in just about every one of your districts, either on a DNR facility or on a parks facility or a trail somewhere. Last year we spent over $100 million providing jobs and also improving our state investment on these activities. And also modeling efficiency, sustainability, and safety. We have solar campground or solar cabins that people can go stay in and see how it works. Facilities that run completely off the grid so they can understand how it does provide those services. Investing in partnerships, processes, and people. We have grants and partnerships with local government units for trail and water rec facilities. A lot of our grant and aid familiar programs you're familiar with, cross-country skis, snowmobile, OHV, Parks and Trails Legacy Grants, our local trail connections program, federal dollars, shoreland and fishing pier programs, and also access development cooperative agreements.
Mr. Meyer, I believe Representative Quam has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, recently I was able to see some of the mobile zoo, you know, where they take animals. They go to the communities across the state. Has there ever been an idea of having a similar situation to get out, you know, examples like you have at the state fair and other locations, but get that out to the middle and elementary schools, let the kids see what they could, you know, unless they're in a scouts program, they probably aren't aware of those activities. And then when you do that in an area, you could have the local or regional activities highlighted, maps, etc. Because, you know, I attended a trails organization meeting in southeastern Minnesota, and they looked at the demographics and the generational effects of the kids not experiencing it. And I wonder if we expanded that outreach with some of the special programs, that not only would they see what's out there, but they might be able to take back and talk to families into doing, you know, day trips and et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, that's a great, great question. In Parks and Trails, we don't have any of those types of programs specifically right now. We do a lot of the outreach and programming at the facilities, at the parks, but MinAqua, the School Forest Program, we do a lot of that across the board with the DNR, but I will make sure that people hear your concern and comment and see what we can do going into the future with that. The I Can Camp program, for example, is after the school hours, but outdoor education programs and making sure people understand, get outside and what's available is something we're trying to expand on. The funding is a issue we have with that, but we're trying to look for partners and things like that wherever we can. So thank you very much. A couple of the quick priority outcomes and measures. You can see this one looking at state park visitation. It increased over 8% in the past 2 years. Also accompanied by a 14% increase in state parks revenue. I think part of this is people are staying closer to home, but also understanding that we have great facilities that they can go to and enjoy some great experiences. and also probably save a few bucks rather than go out state some places like that. Looking at how we're using our websites and making sure people understand things is one of the things we're marketing or targeting as well. And just our website page views have increased over 5% per year. You can go and get a virtual view of our campgrounds. You can see what Campground 52A looks like in a state forest or a state park. You can see our camper cabins online. You can we've really promoted and make sure that we're taking advantage of the digital world that we are in, so people can see at home or at their desk or wherever what the park system is, and then they can make those reservations and plan without having to go through a lot of hoops, so to speak. So we're really excited about expanding those things as well. Members, the last piece of the DNR budget that you'll be hearing about in the future is operations support. This is where our administrative leadership to the department throughout the state is housed. Also delivery services to the public through regional operations and grant administration. Commissioner's office activities and our regional directors and regional offices are funded out of this budget. You can see this slide is kind of skewed a little bit. We aren't using Outdoor Heritage funds to provide funding for the commissioner's office in any way, shape, or form, but the grants that we're passing through here, the $55.1 million, we're the fiscal agent for most of the grants that are going to outdoor-related projects from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, sometimes Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund, and also the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So those dollars are represented here. Primarily, the activities out of this piece of the DNR are funded out of the General Fund, small bit out of the Natural Resources Fund, Game and Fish Fund, and the Special Revenues Fund. Operations support, again, this is the leadership and direction for the department, helps provide cohesive across-the-board formulation, establishment of policies and priorities, coordinate that natural resource management programs and delivery assistance throughout the regions and our regional operations. Also, it provides for our coordinated fire and emergency response assistance, managing our pasture grants, as I talked about, and also the school trust fund fiduciary responsibilities are housed within the commissioner's office, as I spoke of previously. Mr. Chairman, members, I want to thank you for your time. I look forward to spending a lot more time with you all as we come up with the budget and talk about our outcomes and budget measures that we're going to have. For those of you who have been on the Finance Committee in the past, we have a detailed document that we use to show budgeting for results. It's our attempt at zero-based budgeting. I'm working with Mr. Reinholtz on tightening that up for you all and how to present that to you. But we have a document that will show you, for the dollars you're giving the department, what we're going to receive or what we would receive and what your constituents and the citizens of Minnesota will get for those dollars. So we'll determine how best to go through that in a, I don't want to say expedited fashion, but in a timely fashion to provide you with the information you need and the ability to understand the impacts that we'll all be facing into the future. So thank you.
Thank you. I believe Representative Brazkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meyer. It's always intriguing, Mr. Chair and members, as we are here at the legislature, regardless of the presenter that's in front of us, there's oftentimes an appeal to us to demonstrate how much economic activity, particular government activities, are driving. Mr. Meyer, on the parks side, suggested, of course, that we have all kinds of additional economic activity because we've got these state parks out there, but it was interesting at the end. There was at the end of that discussion, it almost seemed circular in that the discussion was, well, maybe people are going out to the parks because they don't have as much money to spend and that they might have to spend when they go elsewhere. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering as we look at these. But, Mr. Meyer, I'm kind of curious what we're seeing in terms of these parks. We have 65 or 67 state parks or something like that, and I know as every other element of government, it's there are plans to continue to increase growth in those areas. I'm curious, and I know I had seen in the past some numbers, but I'd like to see, if we could, kind of a park by park summary of their profitability over time, and how many parks are making money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rakowski, we have that. We've provided that information to the legislature in the past. The purpose of the park system isn't to generate money. I mean, that's why there's general fund support there. It's to provide the citizens of the state with outdoor recreational opportunities. Some of our parks do generate a lot of activity and a lot of money. Some of our parks don't. And those are difficult discussions we need to have in the past as we look at land asset management. Perhaps we turn back some parks to the counties, or we dedicate them for different uses, or maybe they shouldn't be part of the system. But the purpose of the state park system within 86A, the State Outdoor Recreation Act, isn't to provide a profit. Actually, we're hampered by state legislation that says we cannot generate a profit. 16A.1285, I think it is, says that we have to only collect the amount of money we need to provide for those services. So we aren't looking to generate huge amounts of revenue for the state off of these systems. We want to make sure people can understand the heritage that we have and they can enjoy these beautiful places. And I think the discussion on the dollars is, I think people are staying closer to home rather than going out state a lot of times. And we appreciate that because we have a lot of great things to offer here in Minnesota. So,
follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to see those numbers. I thought I remembered at one point there was actually one park out of 60-some that broke even or turned a profit, which would suggest that we are subsidizing visitors at the other 64 or 65 parks. Mr. Meyer, the other question is, and thank you, what has the department done in terms of all the activities over the last week or so? I mean, and thank you for coming here in piece by piece as we go through these, but what types of priorities have you laid out, a kind of a priority list? We're looking at a $6.2 billion difference between the amount of appetite that state government has and the amount of money that the people can afford. Have you looked at within your department and laid out priorities of which areas need to exist into the future and what are areas that would be lower priorities if we were going to cut part of your department out? Which parts would those be? And if we were going to protect parts of your department, which parts would those be? Have you done that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Council, yes, we're actively involved with the Governor's Office on developing a budget, which will be released February 15th. The general fund portion of the DNR is substantially less than the DNR's budget. The DNR's budget's a little bit over $300 million. The general fund is about a quarter of that. So people are paying us to do the things that they want to do, so we want to continue doing that. But where the general fund is, as we spoke of during this presentation, it's in parks and trails, it's in ecological resources and waters, and it's in the Department of Forestry. We need to come up with a reduction scenario that allows us to continue providing the timber for the people to buy, to keep those people working, to keep the parks open to a certain degree. But we also realize we need to take reductions, and we're working to come up with a comprehensive package that will allow us to do that and continuing moving forward in some fashion.
Representative Anderson, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could go back for a second and talk, we talked about acquisition a while earlier. And as the DNR acquires more lands, there are ongoing costs, appeal payments, maintenance, and so forth. How does the DNR plan on addressing the maintenance costs, for example, as we move ahead and possibly acquire more lands and taking care of what you got in addition to the new lands that possibly will be acquired in the future, Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a great question, and I hope to spend some time with you all talking about our land management analysis report that outlines that we can do everything we want to do. There's enough money available in the dedicated funds that are there to continuing acquiring and also manage our lands at a very high level. So as we talked about earlier today, it's looking at different ways of doing things, looking at working with farmers, cattle producers, to provide some management on certain lands, looking at working with people to collect seed sources off of our native prairies, and we can use those seeds and they can use them as well to help propagate our natural species. It's coming up with new and creative solutions, but also prioritizing where we want to be and what we want to do, and selling some land and buying some land. I think we can do, if you take a good look at that report and actually read the individual sections, and you have to take off the state forest piece of it because that's 4.5-5 million acres of land, and what we're really talking about is the forestry operational budget in that report, not the need to manage those lands. But it shows a gap there, but I think everybody has a gap in any budget you're looking at, and we can really manage and acquire lands like we have been in the past decade and make the place a better place, Minnesota a better place to be. But We need to work with you all to understand what our priorities are. We need to understand your priorities, local government's priorities, and develop a process and a program to do all of that. So I think we can do that very successfully.
Representative Purcell, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, I'm trying to get in the context of the discussion here, and there was a bill introduced last year to talk about public lands here, and my district, we have significant public lands, and that affects our tax base. But there was a bill, I think it was last year, that was introduced regarding, I think it was primarily in southern Minnesota, where we were trying to buy our way back into private lands, I think it was, for hunting access, walk-in something. I think Representative Hackbar carried the bill. But it was, they don't have public lands down there enough for hunting. I don't know what the situation was. I'm not that familiar with. But do you recall that? That was, I don't know if I have the name right, but I'm just concerned here that we aren't putting the emphasis on the public lands that we do have, that we don't need to protect here, because we certainly enjoy our hunting in northern Minnesota. I don't want to lose those public lands up there, but there was that situation. I think Representative Hackbarth, I don't mean to single that out, but it sure came to mind. I think it was your bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, there was a bill that was passed by the legislature, unfortunately vetoed by Governor Pawlenty, that established a walk-in access program. Department of Natural Resources and Bowser went ahead and established that program anyway. We'll come back with some more policy language this year. And we actually received some federal funding to begin that program. We were successful in doing that. We need to continue that, put a few more sideboards around it, direct some funding to that program as well. But it's the beginning of hopefully a successful partnership with the private landowners that will provide an access program. It won't be in paramount to what you see in the Dakotas, but for sure it will provide those opportunities and those public-private partnerships to create the opportunity that people are looking for.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. And please, nobody take me wrong here. I don't begrudge that. I just want to make the point that this is what we've had to do because there isn't public land and hunting for some parts of our state. So that's the only point I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer, for your presentation today.
Thank you very much, members.
I'm sorry. Representative Quam, I didn't realize you had another question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, I keep hearing of, is there a goal of, you know, where you want to be at for percentage of acquired land or a mix? You know, because, you know, you're looking to acquire land. I would assume that there's, say, master plan of, in order to support local hunting, we want to have X amount of land in the different areas for the watershed protection, etc. But is there a goal, or it's just sort of, you know, this instance opens up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, again, that's an excellent question. We have, and we're using as our guiding documents, a series of citizen-developed plans. And I can send you the link. We had the same discussion in the Legacy Committee about we have the Duck Plan, for example, the citizen WMA plan that has some long-range goals, actually. And I'm going to send you the link, and you can look at those reports, but also our land management report, because that highlights what those goals are and what they're goals for a reason. People have a vision. Our citizens, our stakeholders have a vision of what they would like to see the state be. We have that. We discuss that, but we also discuss where we've been and where we're going and continue on our path where we need to be, I think. The numbers that are there are pretty high. I'm going to say they're very aggressive goals. I don't know if we would ever achieve them. For example, the WMA goal would be to expand the WMA system by 100% from what we were. I think the goal is 2.5 million acres. I don't know if that's actually achievable, but what they also say is complete the fill-outs, you know, buy in-holdings, work on the roundouts of these units, and really focus on the priority conservation lands. And as I described the strategic land asset management process that we're going to be on, that's going to hone in on those goals on a county-by-county basis. So we work with the county governments, the citizens of those counties, to identify where our priorities should be in that county and how much conservation land we have. So we need to sharpen our pencil on those goals and come up back with those actual objectives, and we're working on that right now.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
I believe we are finished now. Susan Thornton, I believe, and the LCCMR are coming up next. While we have a moment between presentations here, would someone care to approve the minutes of the last meeting? Mm-hmm. Representative Fabian, so moves. I'm getting angry. Let's vote on that today. Just for the heck. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed by the same sign. Thank you. I had a conflicting advice here. Are you ready?
We are ready.
Please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Gibson, and I am the co-chair of the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources.
And Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Thornton. I'm the director of the LCCMR.
And Mr. Chair, I'm Jeff Broberg. I'm the House Citizen Appointee to the LCCMR. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, committee, for hearing us today. As I mentioned before, I am the co-chair. In 2005, the governor changed the makeup of the LCMR, the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, and added seven citizens. And so we now have three co-chairs, one from the citizenry, one from the House, and one from the Senate. And so far it's worked pretty well. The statute recommends that the citizens have some background in natural resources, and we have complied. We have a geologist, we have a forestry expert, we have a former DNR researcher, we have a wildlife biologist, and then we have a woman who heads up a woman's hunting group. So we have complied with that. As you heard earlier from the DNR, that there are many cases where the Environmental Trust Fund has been the foundation for a lot of their different programs. And I would also add that we've been the foundation for a lot of the new monies that have come in from the legacy amendment. For example, we have gone around the state and done a county biological survey. This is where we know where the important plants are, some of the important food for our game and non-game animals. We have done an ID of the wetlands across the state that are good for restoring. We have done a soil survey. The soil is the blood work of our natural resource systems. We need to know where our soils are. And we have done a lot of programs that stimulate younger people to get involved in the outdoors, as you heard previously with our school forest program. We've done a lot of work with eagles and some long-distance learning and the school forest program. So in the summer, we get a book about this size. It's good for exercising your biceps as well. This year, we had 240 projects that came in, and we take those projects and we review all of them. And then we try to prioritize them. And then we have 6 days of presentations. And having a biology background, I can tell you that this has enhanced my skills. I feel like it's a mini master's course. This year we narrowed it down from 240 to 92 projects. I think it's a great set of projects. This year we did keep in mind the recession and tried to focus a little bit on jobs. We do provide about 628 job years. So all in all, we have put the package together, and we have also toured the state. And I think those tours have really been wonderful. We've been able to see some of our projects, some of the successes, some of the needs across the state and also a lot of the opportunities that we have seen and we need to have around the state. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Susan.
Mr. Chair and members, Chair McNamara had asked that we provide to you an overview of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund and an overview of the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. So that's our goal and our focus today, to provide that. And the LCCMR staff are your joint services, nonpartisan staff. We work for all of you. We're down in room 65, and we are available as a resource to each and every one of you. I've been trying to make appointments, meetings with you, and I'm going to continue on that. But don't hesitate. Give us a call first if you wish. I do want to introduce the other staff that are in the audience, Shelley Schreffler, Michael McDonough, and Mike Banker. So I just want you to put a name and a face together that we are your resource there. So as we proceed, the Environment and Natural, and oh, excuse me, also in your packet, I just want to call attention to what you have. You have copies of the slides that I'm about to go through very quickly, and then you also have a summary of our biennial report that was submitted to the legislature January 15th of this year. And I have copies of that full biennial report for anybody if you wish it, if you wish to have it, and it's also available on our web. The other piece is a legal piece that is just, I'm not going to spend any time on it, but it's an overview of the history of the LCMR, LCCMR, and the various funding sources. Trying to answer the anticipate the questions that we often get. So the Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund is it's Minnesota's first constitutionally dedicated funding source for protection of the environment and natural resources. And it's been dedicated three times by the voters. First in 1988, it was established, and then in 1990, 40% of the Minnesota State Lottery proceeds were dedicated through the year 2001 to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And then in 1998, again, there was another constitutional amendment voted on by the voters that further dedicated those 40% of the net lottery proceeds until through the year 2024. And each of those votes, as you can see on the slide, in the at least 74% approval rating by the voters, can only be used for projects of long-term benefit for the environment and natural resources. And the income to the trust fund does come from a combination of the contributions from the Minnesota State Lottery and investment income. So it's essentially, it's an endowment set up in the state treasury. And what's available for expenditure each year is up to 5.5% of the market value. Question we often get asked, I'm just going to cover it. I'm not representing the lottery, but it's really, where do those lottery dollars go? And so that's why this slide is in front of you. And you can see that in the circle, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, those 40% of those net lottery proceeds amounts to about $31 million a year right now. And you can also see at the very top of that slide that the general fund receives approximately $67 million of essentially the remainder of those net proceeds. So again, how does the trust fund work? Right now, the trust fund has approximately $545 million in it. That's the corpus of it. And so there's that $31 million annual contribution invested by the State Board of Investment, 70% in stocks, 30% in bonds. And as I stated before, 5.5% is available, up to available for projects. And the State Board of Investment strives for approximately a 8% growth in the principal balance each year. This is the language from the current Constitution. And as you can see in bold, it says the assets of the fund should be appropriated for the public purpose of protection, conservation, preservation, and enhancement of the state's air, water, land, fish, wildlife, and other natural resources. And other natural resources are statutorily defined as the outdoor recreation system and the metropolitan regional park system. And then we are also the trust fund is governed by Minnesota Statutes Chapter 116P, and 116P.03 states that the trust fund is not to supplant existing funding, traditional sources of funding. Often that's a question that's asked. And then in 116P.05, that is statutorily states what the LCCMR is charged with doing, to recommend an annual or a biennial legislative bill to the legislature, and also that it's a requirement that the each of the appropriations that are made by the legislature then required to have what we call a work program, so it's a scope of work, periodic progress reports, and the commission is charged with the oversight and evaluation of those appropriations on behalf of the legislature. So the commission is making recommendations to you, but then also on your behalf doing that project evaluation. The trust fund, again, is further defined on what it can be spent on and what it cannot be spent on. And 116P.08 has been in existence since 1988, since before the first amendment was voted on by the voters. And there are 8 items, as you can see, that the trust fund may be spent on: the RIM program, research, collection, analysis of information, enhancement of public education, environmental ed, which is some of the things that Mr. Meyer was talking to you earlier, capital projects for the preservation and protection of unique natural resources, activities preserving and enhancing fish, wildlife, and again, restating the elements in the Constitution, administrative expenses, and then there are exceptions of what the trust fund cannot be spent on. And again, this has been in place since 1988. So it's essentially the 6 items there. First one is Superfund. Second one is wastewater treatment. The third, decommissioning of nuclear power plants, hazardous waste disposal facilities, solid waste disposal facilities, or projects that are inconsistent with the adopted strategic plan of the commission. And just, again, focusing on the trust fund, question often asked is, okay, how, since this has been in existence, what has been the performance both with the income and the market value of it? So you can see the first lottery ticket was sold in the spring of 1990. So on this graph, you can see how that the trust fund balance has grown and then also dipped, as many of our investments have dipped. This where you see there the $460 million at the end of June 30th, 2010. That's the marker for what's available for expenditure this next biennium. So constitutionally, as of June 30th, 2010, sets what the dollar amount is, the 5.5% is based on for the upcoming biennium. For this coming biennium, that's about $25 million each year.
Thank you. Ms. Thornton, I just want to be mindful of the time available, so we do allow a little time for questions at the end. Just keep your eye on your wristwatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to be interrupted if you choose to do that. Again, you can look at this. These are the appropriations over the years, and as I spoke to, the $25 million each year as in calendar years 2011 and 12, so fiscal year 12 and 13. What has the trust fund been spent on since 1991? And you can see on the chart, percentage, parks and trails, natural areas, critical lands, fish, wildlife, habitat, natural resource planning, water resources, ag and forestry, environmental ed, administration, renewable energy, and time there was a priority for children's environmental health. All these projects could probably fit in another part of the pie chart. These are kind of shoeboxing them because our goal is that we have multiple benefits. And I'm switching now from the trust fund to the LCCMR. Very quick overview of who the LCCMR is. And it's a 17-member body. It's advisory to the legislature, made up of 5 members of the House, 5 members of the Senate, and 7 non-legislative members, 5 of whom are appointed by the governor, 1 by the Senate, and 1 by the House. I think I pretty much went through this next slide with you already, as did Ms. Gibson. And then just wanted to let you know, and all these projects are on the web, either in the form of a full work program, final report, or a final abstract, and a sense of what the staff is managing right now. Open appropriations, approximately 400 open appropriations, totaling about $165 million. Introduced the staff to you. I indicated that we do have the biennial report to the legislature that's available to you that gives a lot of the background and summary of all the projects. What has the trust fund been spent on? Foundational natural resource data, soils, groundwater, wildlife, prairies, wetlands, lakes, expansion of parks and trails, permanent protection of land and habitat, restoration and enhancement activities, research and analysis for invasive species. You heard a lot about that yesterday. Forestry, water quality, water and energy sustainability, and agriculture. And a very important component of the education, outreach, and technical assistance for wildlife and groundwater and wetlands. Ms. Gibson indicated that we've been around the state, trying to get throughout the state and districts to get out in the field so that we can actually talk to natural resource managers, local units of government, and find out what's needed in their region of the state. This is just a snapshot of what the commission did in this last year. Northeast Minnesota, Minnesota River Valley, Mississippi River Corridor, we do coordinate with the LaSard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, and then we try and pull in a number of expert-led seminars. Just this last year, we focused on the Gulf oil spill, Minnesota's migrating birds, shoreline regs, conservation easements, community planning, and emerging tree diseases and pests. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Broberg, who...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. By way of introduction, my name is Jeff Broberg. I'm the House appointee to the Citizens part of the LCCMR. I'm a licensed professional geologist with 34 years of professional experience after graduating from the University of Minnesota. I worked in the oil and gas industry, the landfill gas industry, aggregate mining, resources, and water resource management. I'm also the president of the Minnesota Trout Association. I came to this after 10 years of serving on DNR budget oversight committees. And in 2005, Governor Pawlenty appointed me to the task force to look at the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund. And after those recommendations were made and the LCCMR was formed, I was appointed by Speaker Spigum to the committee. I was reappointed last year for another term. What I wanted to talk about today is how we kind of do our business, and an important part of this is the strategic plan that's actually required by statute 116P08 sub 3 that says we put together a six-year strategic plan that lays out our vision, our goals, our strategies, and really puts together the process that we work through. It's important I mention this because this is the year that strategic plan is scheduled to be redone and looked at once again to make sure that it's current. I think there's some important parts to this. The vision statement basically says that all Minnesotans have an obligation to use and manage our resources, promoting stewardship enhancement for ourselves and the future. And it should be used to nurture a sense of responsibility by all further understanding of our resources. The missions go on to identify things over time and taking the long view and the foundation elements that we need to make sure we manage our resources. Some of the things that I've learned and that surprised me is this. I'm a subject expert. I'm a geologist, and I'm most familiar with southeastern Minnesota. I'm a little parochial in that regard. I don't get around the state that much. But I was surprised to learn, for instance, some of the things that Bob Meyer had talked about that hadn't been adequately addressed. The land management record system, for example, has now been funded by the LCCMR to get our hands around all of the lands that are owned, leased, managed, have easements on them across the state, a very important gap that occurred that the funding has been used for. Another element was the soil survey. This is, to me and my business, one of the fundamental documents that define the characters of our soil that's used for agriculture, forestry, water management, urban planning, and that had not been completed across the state. That's on maps that are done on a county basis, and it's only been through the efforts in this year's bill, actually, that would fund the completion of that soil survey across the state. Invasive species work has been a priority year after year for us. 2 years ago, we looked mostly at carp. This last year, emerald ash borer, and we're constantly seeking the advice of experts and programs that address those issues. An important part of the strategic plan was a recognition that we needed to compile for the state of Minnesota what's known, and it was commissioned through the report that is published here, the Minnesota Statewide Conservation Plan. For all the members, paper copies of these are available in the office or it can be viewed online. A very important set of maps at a township scale across the state that identify resources to risks and everything that goes into the assessment of those that can be fairly complicated, and it does a very good job of identifying those things, and it really points us to the strategic plan elements that have identified 7 key natural resource issues, 5 strategic goals, and lays out those goals and criteria, including the criteria for review. I want to wrap up my comments talking a little bit about the applicants to the Environment and Natural Resource. We put out a request for proposals, and it brings, based on the strategic plan and those goals and strategies, it brings forward the best and brightest in Minnesota, those people that are the most motivated, have the capacity and the wherewithal and the track record to do this. Their process starts over a year before they have any hope of funding. The RFP requires them to put together their partnerships, their leverage, the other cost share, the people that will participate, and be very detailed about their goals, and then educate everybody about their needs. They take a lot of time and effort to do that, and their program goes on to the benefit of the state. The things that I've learned are the importance of language. I never realized as a businessman the importance of statutory language and how important it is to know the meaning and intent. But also that the LCCMR plays an important role as a knowledge-based institution that provides learning and understanding while managing the trust fund and dealing with the needs that we ask the applicants to identify across the state. I'm going to turn it over to Nancy to talk about the criteria for this, and thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just briefly, because I know we're running out of time, in addition to looking at that book, we try to prioritize all the projects, and we also use an evaluation guide. And as you can see on the slide, the projects have to fit the request for proposals because they do change. They change with our strategic plan. We want to make sure that they have multiple benefits. So something that might affect land will take context, the water issue, and the fact it may be an invasive species. We try to make sure that they are all interrelated, just like nature. We want to make sure we have an outcome that's very clearly defined. And we want to make sure that once we do these projects, that knowledge base isn't put on a shelf, but it's used across the state. We also want to deal with the extent of the impacts. We want to make sure that it's just not from a small region, but that it really affects the larger region and sometimes the state. Innovation. Innovation is very key to a lot of our projects. This is one fund where people can come here, scientists in particular, can come and say, hey, this could work. Let's try to fund it, and in many cases, it's been very successful. We really pride ourselves on science and technical basis. These science projects are peer-reviewed, not just by Minnesotans, but from around the nation. And then we deal with urgency. We talked earlier about the BP oil spill. We really wanted to see some of the impacts on that. And we also make sure they're ready, that these projects are ready to go. And in order to stretch our dollar, we try to make sure that they do have some leverage dollars if it is appropriate. That way they've got some skin in the game. And then, again, this year I talked about jobs were an issue for us as well.
So, Mr. Chair, in conclusion, the last biennium, approximately $51 million was appropriated from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. for these environmental projects. This year, the commission is recommending to the legislature approximately, again, $51 million for 92 projects from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund and also the oversight of the Land and Water Conservation. So you'll be seeing that in legislative bill form later this session. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we look forward to working with you. And again, any questions, we'd be happy to address.
Thank you for the presentation. I believe Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Thornton, you were throwing out some numbers, and I maybe got confused. You mentioned there were $25 million set aside as of last June 30th. Was that for projects for this coming year then for the LCCMR?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you. I did go through those quickly. What's available each year of the biennium is approximately $25 million constitutionally. So there were approximately $25 million worth of $25 million of appropriations that began this past July 1. There is $25 million available each year of the upcoming biennium also.
Follow up. Again, thanks, Mr. Chair. So does that $25 million, is that the money appropriated for projects, or do the administrative costs also come out of that figure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the administrative costs were appropriated in the first year of the biennium last year, the whole amount. This year, you'll be seeing administrative costs appropriated each year of the upcoming biennium.
Representative Scott, I believe you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if this probably goes to Ms. Thornton. I'm just wondering what happens when a project comes up that benefits the employer of an LCCMR member, and say the University of Minnesota. How do you handle that situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, the LCCMR has adopted procedures and very specific, I'd be happy to provide those to you. Very specific related to conflict of interest, and we have a process for addressing that of members declaring that conflict of interest and recusing themselves from any discussion of that particular project.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thornton. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, presenters. I'm looking at the plans for this next year, I understand there's about 25 or 26 million from the fund available, and first question would be, is it normal for us to be planning for a full biennium or to go 1 year at a time? And then I look at what's being planned, and you may have heard some of the earlier discussion in Minnesota here. We've learned through two reports in the last year that we have bought more land and continue on an unsustainable trajectory that brings us more land liabilities than we can afford to manage. As I look at what your plans are for the next year, there's two areas I have questions about. They consume about 60% of your budget, and that is the areas of doing more mapping and planning and resource inventories, and you know, we've seen a bunch of these. We just sent $750,000 to the university, and we heard their study here one day earlier. And then we've got more land acquisition, $12.5 million here, and then there's some others. The people of Minnesota really want this money to get out and see it do things. Kind of, you know, you look at, for instance, the habitat restoration activities you did in 2009, 2010. I mean, those are the types of things I think that people are looking at. So I'm curious about what your plans are as you move forward. Are we planning to see more of these planning and land purchase approaches, or are we going to actually see this money get on the ground where people can use it? And the other question is, we are in a very difficult budget situation. What types of efforts are you guys looking at to help us relieve us from where we're at here in the next few years?
Mr. Chair and Member Drazkowski, if I can address maybe one of you. I listed about four or five different questions you had there, but I'd like to talk to a couple of them. And first about the annual versus biennial approach to the spending here. I was part of the task force that originally recommended that we do annual approach to that, and that was in respect to the applicants principally. There had been instances where applicants had applied, did all of their work, put their plans together, and it would be 2 years before they would get their money. That seemed like a waste of intellectual capital and effort. So one of the things we wanted to do is make sure that the people that weren't going to get the money learned no early, and the others had the opportunity to get their funding in a relatively rapid fashion. So we recommended a year cycle. I was a champion of that, and I've since changed my mind. That has lost for us an important element, I think, of the committee. It seems like no matter if we do annual or biannual, we get 300 to 350 applicants. It took me 60 hours to read all of those and 15 days of hearings to go through them. It doesn't leave enough time to learn or know the other things, to move around the state or to have that opportunity as the committee to have good advice to the legislature. So we have recommended going back to the two-year cycle. And a predicate of that is still be respectful of the applicants. I hope that answers your question. On land acquisition, we've struggled over that and looked at that, and it is part of the Constitution. It's part of the statutes. It's part of the strategic plan. So we feel like we've been honoring that element to those plans. Again, stressing the importance of revising those for current times. I think that is the prudent path to go down. So the things that get done on the ground, many of them cannot be done without the research and the studies. Soil survey is a perfect example. It has so much to do with things like wildlife management and invasive species and groundwater contamination. If that's not completed across the state, we do not have the foundation elements to understand what the most prudent things to do on the ground are. And we need to complete that investment in the biological survey, the soil survey, the county geologic atlas. Those are foundation elements that we can't do a good job of managing in Minnesota without. I'm going to let Susan answer a couple of the other questions.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. And I just want to, Mr. Chair, Representative, we also require restoration up front. So we don't take our land acquisitions or our easements lightly. We want to make sure that we are doing them very carefully. And one project that we have been extremely cognizant of is a lot of the hunting and fishing groups came to us and wanted to talk to us about conservation corridors. It's a very key element of conservation biology. It allows a combination of private owners to get into restoration work, easements, acquisitions, and what we are really tying that to are the wildlife and the plant species that are in our state. It's been very successful. It's modeled after something that is out west, and we have come to use that as a very important tool for the LCCMAR. Also, earlier was mentioned the scientific and natural areas. They are sort of in between funding. They get a little bit from the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. We have tried to fund them very selectively. We know they're incredibly critical for our state, so we have taken a good stab at some of those. We're never going to be able to fulfill that. And also, we a lot of times we do inholdings. This year we did some inholdings for the parks as well. So we don't take this lightly. We do it with willing landowners, and we try to do a very, very coordinated effect that will actually benefit the entire state.
Thank you. I believe Representative Dill has a question. We have very little time, so please make it concise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering to any of you, thank you for coming today. Do you do most of your work in conservation easements and things of that nature, or in acquisition? And if it is acquisition, who then picks up the pill, the payment in lieu, after we acquire it with these dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, and welcome to the Commission, Representative Dill. We look forward to working with you on the Commission. It's a combination of conservation easements and acquisition, and I have that number somewhere in my pile of papers for this year. I'd be happy to get back to you on that. Yeah. The PILT issue has not been directly addressed through the Environment and Natural Resources Task Force.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can add to that, many of the purchases go to other units as well that aren't paying bill payments to the counties. Not many, but there are different units of government. Waterfowl management areas, the funding for those is one of those examples. County parks is another one that have been funded. So, but the pilt is the gorilla in the room.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation today. We are running out of time. I have a few comments. The LCCMR has been appointed some new members, and they will be joining you soon. I don't know when you'll be meeting, but I believe that they will be reviewing the bill that is to be presented this year, and that bill will then come before this committee. So we look forward to that. We have a document in your packets from Mr. Reinholz. I will hope you all will keep that so he doesn't have to hand it out again at our next meeting, which is scheduled for Tuesday, February 8th. Thank you, Ms. Thornton, Mr. Broberg, and Ms. Larson for your presentation. Today's meeting is adjourned.